This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll have Christy Nichols, the Commissioner of Administration, to discuss the budget and Medicaid and much more. Also, Christopher Guth, he is the Vice President of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We'll talk with him about fracking and natural gas in Louisiana. And Renee Chatelaine from the Manship Theater will stop by. The European Film Festival is taking place at the Manship this weekend. And we'll hear from Bobby Terrio. He was on the 1961 LSU baseball team, which won the SEC title. In those days, LSU didn't win many titles on the diamond. In fact, that was the only one between 1946 and 1975. The 61 team had some big names and some names that might surprise you, like Frank Palazzola. We'll talk about it with Bobby Terrio. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Frank Barnett is producing. And in studio is Bobby Terrio from LSU. He will precede the Commissioner of Administration, Christy Nichols, who is slated to be with us in our second segment. And since we're talking sports to begin the program, congratulations to Odell Beckham, the LSU receiver. Odell Beckham Jr. picked 12th in the first round by the New York Football Giants, and he will head to the Meadowlands to play along with Reuben Randall, the former Tiger, who is also a member of the Giants, catching passes from Eli Manning of New Orleans. Today's Advocate story about Mr. Beckham refers to him as Odell Beckham Jr. I don't think there was an Odell Beckham Sr., so editors aren't what they used to be. But Bobby Terrio is here, and back in 1961, he was starring for the LSU Baseball Tigers. And in those days, baseball was not the sport it is now at LSU, and between 1946 and 1975, LSU only had one championship, and it was in 1961. And Bobby Terrio was there, and some other sterling examples of athletic brilliance were on that team. It was quite a group of characters, was it not, Bobby Terrio?
Yes, it was.
Well, tell us about some of the teammates you had who are memorable.
Well, we had it was really a great team. The rosters in those days were only 20, and we had six football players, six people that were on football scholarships that played on the team. Len Amedy, who was also a quarterback for the football team. Mooney Winston played with us, and Mooney was an All-American guard on the football team. And then
okay, you're fading in and out, but I think we got you now.
You got me now. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
So you got Len Amedy.
Right.
And Mooney Winston played in four Super Bowls with the Minnesota Vikings.
That's correct.
These are guys synonymous with football, but people forget they were outstanding baseball players.
That's correct. Our All-American pitcher was actually on a basketball scholarship, Alan Smith. And Alan was 10-2 that year, and he was an incredibly good pitcher.
And he recently died.
He passed away, that is correct. And our center fielder was John Bailey, who was an all-SEC center fielder and was on a basketball scholarship. And he was on the first basketball team to ever beat Kentucky, I believe, in Baton Rouge. The strength of the team was our defense, and we had John Thomas at shortstop, and Larry Edmondson was our second baseman. And they were just incredible in terms of fielding, probably is at definitely major league caliber fielder. So we were very strong up the middle, very good defensively, above average speed, and we had timely hitting, but no real superheroes on that team.
And it was 1961. Football then was king. Paul Dietzel led the Fighting Tigers on the football field that year to a 10-1 record. Baseball was not in the same league with football. Maybe it still isn't, but LSU does lead the nation in baseball attendance. You were playing at the old Alex Box Stadium. What kind of crowds did the team normally draw?
Well, we would draw a couple of hundred only.
A couple of hundred.
When we played Ole Miss, the first series at home, The stands were packed, and we set the all-time attendance record when we played Auburn for the championship at 2,500 people. So we really didn't see big crowds.
And you only played 25 games that year.
That's correct. We were 20-5.
20-5, and after you won the championship, was there an NCAA tournament?
Yes, there was, but we did not participate.
Now, why not? You were the SEC champs.
Well, the state had a segregation law that was struck down by the Supreme Court, and after it was struck down, though, the Board of Supervisors honored this the segregation part of it because they didn't want to alienate any of the legislators. So when we won the championship, we were asked to stay home.
And so in essence, you not only didn't have any black people on your team, you were not allowed to play any other teams with black athletes.
That is correct. However, that summer...
And that was true not only of baseball, but football, basketball, all the sports.
That is correct. That is correct. An interesting sidebar, though, was that summer we were a core for the Ponchatoula semi-pro team. And we went to the National Baseball Congress, which was the semi-pro tournament in Wichita, Kansas, and we got to play the USC team that was the core for one of the California teams that won the championship, and we beat them. So we always wondered in our mind how far we could have gone if, in effect, we'd have gotten the ability to play.
Well, that seems unbelievable today, 53 years later, that LSU would refuse to play in a tournament because – you might somewhere along the way, some way, somehow, play a team that has some African-Americans. Times have changed in this regard, I think, to the better.
Absolutely. In fact, when we win that tournament, we played against African-Americans then, and they were some incredibly good athletes.
Well, Bobby Terrio was a member of that team, and if we do the math, that's 53 years ago. You're obviously... into your 70s. He looks great. He looks like he could still put on a uniform and catch long fly balls. But some of the people on that team, other than Alan Smith, have passed away, including Judge Frank Palazzolo. People forget he was a pretty good baseball player.
That's correct. Frank passed away. We lost one of our pitchers very recently, Lester Mitz. And Hadley Smith, who played left field, had a heart attack and died at a very early age. So we have four people down.
And to this weekend, you've got an impromptu reunion of sorts. I know you take great pride in the championship season, but there are some others who have the same kind of puffed-up chest when it comes to talking about 1961. Is Roy Winston going to be here?
Mooney will be there.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, Mooney makes all of our reunions. He tells everybody that of all this, his sporting days, that the most fun he had was the year that he played with us in baseball, including his years in pro.
Well, he did play in four Super Bowls, lost them all, but how many guys play in four Super Bowls with the Minnesota Vikings? He was only about 220 pounds playing linebacker, and I remember Larry Zonka saying the hardest he was ever hit was by Roy Winston.
He was a great teammate. He had no ego, and he was a wonderful team player.
Now, in those days, I don't know if they did pitch counts, but Lynn Amity, who was a star quarterback for the Tigers, later to become an assistant coach in two iterations with LSU, he had a record of 6-1, and in one game pitched 11 innings, and he had to throw a lot of pitches because he gave up five runs, but he won 6-5 over Auburn in the final game of the SEC Championship Series. He probably threw 170 or 80 pitches that day.
Yeah, no question. We always we kid Lynn and tell him that that he was approaching his 200 pitch count.
The 200 pitch.
Yeah, but at the I don't think he got there. But in those days, if you remember, the starters pitched. There was no such thing as middle relief, and basically the relievers only came in when the starters really got rocked or just really truly ran out of gas. And so Lynn pitched a wonderful game. He's very competitive. Lynn didn't think anybody could beat him, and he was very confident, and he pitched hard, and he kept us in that game the whole time.
Well, Amity was the only quarterback in LSU history to play on an SEC championship baseball team in the spring and an SEC championship football team in the fall. Jimmy Field was his partner in crime with the Tigers back in the day, and of course we know Jimmy, who became a well-known public service commissioner. You know, he doesn't talk at all about his LSU heroics. Jimmy Field doesn't. His son Mark told me that he went years into his youth before he knew his dad played at all, football or baseball. But he was also a multi-sport threat, wasn't he?
Yeah. In fact, our junior year, Jimmy came out and played. And let me tell you, he was an incredible athlete and a wonderful person.
Your coach was Ray Didier.
Yeah, Ray did a wonderful job with us. He really stressed fundamentals. We worked very hard on situations. And the reality of it is when you look at the way our team was composed with based on pitching defense with good speed, we couldn't make a lot of mistakes and win games. And I credit a lot of that to the fact that DDA had us so fundamentally sound. We could be beat, but you had to beat us. We didn't beat ourselves.
Bobby Terrio, former LSU baseball stalwart who had success beyond the diamond, and he graduated from LSU in 1963. In those days, ROTC was mandatory, correct?
That is correct.
You had to shave your head?
Freshman year, we all did.
And you took those ROTC credentials and put them to use after graduation.
Yes, I did.
What'd you do?
I was a pilot in the Air Force for 5 years.
For 5 years. And how was that experience? That must have been during the Vietnam era.
It was. I when I graduated from pilot training in Laredo, the war had not heated up yet. And so based on where I finished in my class, I got an instructor slot and went straight to instructing from there. And during the middle of the, I instructed for 2 years on the flight line, and then I was a check pilot for 2 years and got frozen because we had to turn out so many pilots for Vietnam. So I was very fortunate during that time period. I spent 4 years at the same base.
And then around 1968, you get out of the military and you go to work as a civilian working for Merrill Lynch.
In Baton Rouge, that's correct.
Started as an account executive.
That is correct.
Yeah, and I'm sure you advised a lot of people through the years in different capacities with different companies on how to invest their funds.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Were you good?
Well, I'd like to think so. Yeah, I love the business. It was wonderful, and I ended up, as you know, staying with Merrill Lynch for 38 years. I was a lifer.
All right. Well, 297-5633 is your number for Bobby Terrio in our remaining moments with him. Hawk on Corsi asks, do you like aluminum bats?
No. Of course, we played with wooden bats, and the mound was 6 inches higher, so it was a different game.
Yeah, they lowered the mound in the majors after the 68 season.
That's correct.
When Bob Gibson had a 1.12 ERA and 13 shutouts with the Cardinals, and everybody else was keeping the score down, too. Denny McClain won 31 games that year, but people like offense. They like to see the ball go over the wall, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I think the problem with the metal bats is whether I think it'll be difficult to change the bats now because of the safety concern. They're going to go to the minor league ball next year to try to take some of the seams off of it, so it'll be harder to throw breaking balls. And supposedly it'll carry 10 or so feet further. And outside of that, about the only thing I think they'll be able to do is if they consider moving in fences.
Well, they did that when Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's record. They moved in the fences at Fulton County Stadium. It's been done before, and nothing wrong with that. Some parks are easier to homer in than others.
No question.
Yeah. So when you think about the game as a whole, now people sign contracts out of college or high school in the millions to play baseball. In your day, there wasn't even a $100,000 bonus baby yet, and there was no major league free agent draft until 64. Times have changed. Would you have pursued a career as a professional if you were in a contemporary setting?
Well, I'd like to have played pro ball, but the reality was college was where I needed to be, and I don't think I would have ever been able to get to the major leagues in pro, and obviously that would have been the only reason I tried it. But you talk about bonuses. One of the persons that we played with was Butch Mixon, who was the first bonus baby of the Houston Colts, and he got a $20,000 bonus, which was huge in those days.
Huge. $20,000 in those days was like 2 years of pay for the average American.
That's true.
Well, thank you, Bobby Terrio, and you look great, and we look forward to talking with you again very soon. And we shall return, if all goes according to plan, with the Commissioner of Administration, Christy Nichols. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We are waiting for Commissioner of Administration, Christy Nichols, who requested to be with us today, and hopefully she will call in as scheduled, and we will have a nice discussion with her about the budget, which, of course, is changing as we speak, and there is much maneuvering at the Capitol in the final weeks of the session as lawmakers prepare to go home in just a few weeks, but a lot of heavy lifting to do between now and first week of June. And Christy Nichols, of course, is involved intricately in every segment of the budget. And Medicaid has been a chief topic of discussion in the last few days. And a new wrinkle was thrown in the mix last Friday as federal officials rejected Governor Jindal's financing plans for the privatization of six state-owned hospitals that care for the poor and uninsured, dealing a potentially significant blow to healthcare operations across the state. And the decision threatens agreements that already have been used to turn over hospital management, possibly creating chaos in the operating budget for this year. Certainly in the years to come, even bigger implications. Melinda DeLott from the Associated Press in her story saying the deals are costing the state $1.1 billion this year, much of it relying on expected federal health care dollars. The six hospital deals denied last Friday were estimated to cost $882 million in the current budget year, most of that assumed to be covered through federal funds. Now, in the last few days at the Capitol, there have been interesting and creative maneuvers by lawmakers, and one offered by Ben Nevers, the Democratic state senator from Bogalusa, is profiled in today's column in the Baton Rouge Advocate from Stephanie Grace, and Ben Nevers was on this show Monday and talked about his redoing of his Medicaid bill after lawmakers shot down his bid to put the Medicaid expansion that Governor Jindal has bypassed or refused on the ballot. Ben Nevers has redone his bill to essentially put in all the planks that Governor Jindal has offered and calls it Louisiana First, America Next. And whether or not this is political gamesmanship or an act of sincerity or perhaps both, the first step has been cleared unanimously by Senator Nevers as the Senate Health and Welfare Committee passed his bill. And testifying at Ben Nevers' request was the Department of Health and Hospitals Secretary Kathy Kleber. So it will be interesting to follow, and we are joined now by Christy Nichols, the Commissioner of Administration. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you.
Well, what's going on with Medicaid?
Well, as you know, and I know I heard Robert Travis Scott this morning talking about it on public radio, but we as you know, in June and July of last year, submitted state plan amendments that we're seeking approval to pay claims for uninsured care and Medicaid rates in the private hospitals that are now operating the charity hospitals. So that, while that reimbursement methodology is a pretty standard methodology, meaning, you know, all across the country, private hospitals provide care to the uninsured and to Medicaid in lieu of having a charity hospital infrastructure. So the reimbursement methodology was fairly standard, but CMS has raised concerns with respect and denied the state plan amendments because they raised some concerns about the means of financing associated with some of the deals. So we've been in discussions with CMS. I think that the good news is that the partnerships are going to go forward. And the reason that we're able to do that is because CMS has recognized that the reimbursement that we're requesting to pay the hospitals is, that methodology is fine. They in a call we had with them on Wednesday, recognized that it was a standard methodology that they could approve. And they've even commented that they like the model itself in terms of how we're providing care and see that it is working. As you probably know, as we've made the conversion into the private hospital settings, there's been a lot of progress statewide and a lot of success in the models. We've decreased wait times, increased service levels. Patients have access to oncology, cardiology services that they didn't have access to before. In many instances, patients were going to Shreveport for services or transferred to New Orleans, and those patients could have been coming from Lafayette or Lake Charles. So the delivery of care and the access to care that we're providing to patients is significantly better, and so the quality of care is better, and I think overall we're impacting those patients' lives positively. Have room to negotiate with CMS is, again, as I mentioned, the means of financing, and that's essentially how the state has financially structured the transactions. One aspect of the whole public-private partnerships was related to the private hospitals leasing the public hospital infrastructure that they were taking over. And while that is a standard transaction in terms of the private hospitals are obligated to pay for the state's assets, and they've done that via contract where they're leasing the facilities over 40 years, and making lease payments on an annual basis. Some of those hospitals structured their lease agreements where they made some payments up front, and that was deducted from their lease payment obligation in future years. But it's that financial arrangement where some of the hospitals paid more money up front that has raised questions with CMS. And so what they've asked us is essentially they need to better understand how those payments were utilized before they can move forward with the full approval.
All right. Well, what does this rejection last Friday do as far as the budget right now? Does it make you have to plug a hole, or is it a wait and see? What's going on?
The way that the Medicaid program is financed from the federal government is they get an annual grant, and that grant is paid to the state in October in full. And so we received our annual grant last year in October, and that payment has been made for the full year. So we're paid through that grant through the end of September. So if we were to reach an agreement with CMS and for some reason they wanted to back out, for example, the federal share of the lease payments, what they likely could do is when we receive our October payment in this year, which takes us through September of next year, they could make a deduction on that overall payment. Now, obviously, that grant payment is huge. And so if our calculations are correct and the issue specifically that CMS is taking issue with is the advanced lease payments, which they've said it is, we could be looking at, let's say, $185 million offset to that grant payment, which would effectively impact us in the next fiscal year, and that would be FY16. So for the year that we're in, which is FY14, and for the year that we're budgeting for now in the legislature, which is FY15, there's no immediate impact. So there's no need to restructure the budget as it relates to those negotiations with CMS at this point. And again, in our recent discussions with CMS, I think there's still a good bit of room to further educate CMS about the structure of the advanced lease payments, what those lease payments were used for, and then we can move forward in addressing that issue singularly. And the department's planning to put forward a new state plan amendment next week that would specify the reimbursement methodology. And I think we'd be successful in getting approval for those state plan amendments, and then we would be left to resolve the issue of the advanced lease payments.
All right, there's a bill that is being debated that's still alive and at this point well, House Bill 142 from Representative Richard, that has been touted by Treasurer Kennedy as a panacea for the state's budget ills, providing for a 10% reduction in all state professional, personal, and consulting service contracts, and providing for the deposit of the savings into the Higher Education Financing Fund. What do you think of this legislation, Commissioner?
Well, I mean, I think that we all want to look at ways to find efficiencies in government, and certainly we're always looking at the best approach for how to do that. I take issue with the bill because I think it gives some false hope in terms of how you can do that and the impact of doing that when you do it in a way that is across the board, unstructured, and essentially you make a decision to cut across the board and you don't know the impact of that decision. We've never cut across the board. We've never taken that approach because it's dangerous. You don't know the impact of the decision unless you analyze it contract by contract to ensure that you haven't hurt people. And I think that that's fundamentally the problem that we have with the bill. I think there's a lot of misinformation about, number one, the level of savings that you would get from that approach. Right now, I think the contracts that he's targeting total about $3 billion. So 10% of that obviously is $300 million. And then, you know, how that $300 million is broken down between federal and state funds, it's usually about 70-30. So then you get into the fact that you're really only looking at potentially, and this is real money, and I don't argue that point, and we have to do all that we can to find ways to achieve savings. But again, you get down to looking at $30 million in general fund savings, and then you've got to go through where are those savings coming from, even if you're saving federal dollars. And the reality is there is no way to get that revenue unless you cut contracts in coastal. So the bill itself effectively cuts our coastal restoration efforts arbitrarily. And while he excluded Medicaid contracts, he still is leaving in every social contract, every medical contract that's in the Department of Social Services, for example. He's cutting correctional contracts, corrections contracts, it's health services, it's pharmacy services, it's food services. You've got contracts within the Office of Juvenile Justice, providing mentorship and programs for kids that we don't want to enter into the juvenile justice system. And that's the reality of implementing that bill. That is where we would have to go to get those reductions.
All right. Now, Louisiana has cut funding for higher education by more than 43% since 2008, according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. And that includes tuition hikes, by the way. Commissioner, were those cuts, and mind you, most of them were long before you became Commissioner of Administration, but were those cuts necessary, or could other decisions have been made to preserve funding for higher education?
You know, we've all had to make significant choices about how we reduce government overall to contend with some of the challenges that we've faced over the last 5 or 6 years with respect to managing some of the economic challenges, even though Louisiana's done much better than the rest of the country with respect to our economy not only being stabilized but growing with investments like with companies from Sasol and Nucor and major economic investments. Jobs are growing at a faster rate in Louisiana than in the country. We've got more people moving to Louisiana because of these jobs. Those are all great things, and I think we've fared very well considering. But overall, government has had to make choices about what we fund and how we can find efficiencies. And higher ed certainly has had to be a part of that process. I think what's not said much in the discussion or enough is the investments that have been made in higher education. And I know you probably know that TOPS has grown by $100 million over the last 6 years. We've invested more in GO grants. We've doubled them from $16 million to $26 million. We just recently in the executive budget put $40 million in for the WISE Fund. That's to grow high-demand jobs in the higher ed system, and made other investments. And so, yes, while general fund in higher education has been reduced. Overall, the financing for higher education overall has stayed stable. And, you know, I know you probably know this too, but our overall funding for higher education, and that does include tuition and other means of financing like federal funds and statutory dedications, like the use of the tobacco revenue to shore up funding for the TOPS program. But we have $2.3 billion in the executive budget for FY15 for higher education, and that's an overall almost 7% increase from our last year's budget. So we've made investments. We've made a lot of capital investments in the higher education system, over $700 million. And, you know, obviously higher education for us is a huge priority. And so as we move forward with making decisions in the future about where to make key investments, that's going to be our top priority.
Charles on North Foster, we only have a few minutes left with the commissioner, but please be brief. You were on the air with Commissioner Nichols, Charles.
Thank you for being brief, Jim. I have a question for the commissioner. She mentioned efficiency several times. Kent, your boss had a $1 billion surplus, and in about one term, he used it up, yet he's using that same figure, $1 billion, to justify not expanding Medicaid. Can you explain the logic? And my last question is, why did the state enter into a contract with the Lady of the Lake?
All right. Go ahead. The floor is yours, Commissioner.
Well, in terms of the last question, Our Lady of the Lake, as you know, took over Earl K. Long, so they were the private partner to assume the services for that public hospital system. And that particular partnership has been pretty significant in terms of some of the success. The clinics themselves have had more than 126,000 patients in clinic visits and seen 30,000 people in their urgent care centers since it was opened, and it's on track to be a level one trauma center. So the Lake has done a phenomenal job in taking over Earl K. Long. We've had some legislators like Representative Barrow and Senator Broom who've done a phenomenal job advocating for the patients at Earl K. Long and making sure, for example, that the CAT system put in place new routes to make sure that people had access to Our Lady of the Lake in the new location. We've provided obstetrics through Women's Hospital, and the transportation specifically was resolving some transportation issues to get out to that site.
Well, so, what about, we're short, we only have a minute left, but what about the use of one-time funds to plug budget holes? You've certainly gotten some scrutiny on that. The governor at one point said he didn't like this kind of philosophy or strategy, but he seems to have embraced it.
The reality is one-time money has always been in Louisiana's budget, always. And, you know, we have to pick strategically how we utilize those funds. And certainly in times where we have surpluses, we make decisions about utilizing that in infrastructure and in other areas of our economy, whether it be coastal projects, et cetera. And then as we've worked to not raise taxes for the state, and that's the mandate that our citizens have asked for, we have invested those one-time dollars in ways that help us stabilize the budget, and I think it's incumbent upon us to do that. I think it's incumbent upon the state to find ways to generate revenue.
Well, Commissioner, we thank you. We know you're busy, and thanks for your time, and let's do this again soon. We would like that.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care. We shall return after this brief timeout with a flurry of guests in our final segment. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. A few minutes now with one of the fabulous people in our community, Renee Chatelaine, who runs the Manship Theater. And as usual, the Manship Theater is buzzing. And we've talked this week about the International Film Festival that's going on at Perkins Row. But my goodness, we're doubly blessed. What's going on at the Manship?
Really good news for Baton Rouge altogether that we can have the International Film Festival and also our European Film Festival, our International Film Festival, with regard to Euro-American celebrations that are going on throughout the state. And in fact, today, May 9th, is European Union Day. So we're couching our festival around that particular celebration, and we're working with the Consulate General of France in New Orleans as well as the Consulate General of Switzerland, though our films also span Italy and Germany, and lots of live entertainment as well.
All right. What will be showing?
So tonight at 6:30, we start with a German film. The English version of that is, the title is Two Lives, and it will be preceded by a talk with Assistant Professor of Foreign Language and Literature Studies, Dr. Gwendola Hochman, and German-born actor and dancer Eltara Ibrahim, and they will discuss sort of their ties to Germany and their thoughts about the particular film. In between those, that film and the next feature will be live music in the Lamar Atrium provided by Will Robichaud. And then the last film is French. It will be introduced by the representative from the European, sort of the coordinator of these events, the Consulate General Beatrice, and she will introduce the film, The French Minister. And the really cool thing is after that film, the curtains will rise on the stage and the screen will go away, and we will have a pianist and lovely singer, Christine Reynaud, who will serenade us, and the whole audience will be invited to be on the stage in a cafe setting to enjoy post-film festivities.
All right, so it's quite a night at the Manship Theater.
Yes, it is.
And,
yes, it is.
There are many nights that are especially spectacular at the Manship. What do you have coming up soon that we should keep an eye on?
Well, we have we always like to parallel our events with what is going on in the city, and we know the Country Music Superfest is coming. So right before those events take place, we have Los Lobos coming in, and that should be really fun. And then in celebration of the British Invasion year, we have Peter Noon and Herman's Hermits this summer.
We got to get Peter Noon on the show.
Oh, we will work hard to make that happen, Jill. And then just lots of film activities, lots of live performance, Edwin McCain Trio, just some really, our flamenco group will be back. And in fact, a group is going to Spain with Manship on the Move. So we've lots of exciting things.
Well, we look forward to a longer visit sometime soon. But tonight you get started. What time?
It starts at 6:30 and tickets are $12 for the whole night.
Okay. So it's a big night of European film at the Manship Theater. Thank you so much, Renee.
Thank you, Jim.
We're joined now by Christopher Guth. He's Vice President for Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Institute for 21st Century Energy. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning, Jim.
And you are in Baton Rouge.
I am.
What brings you to our fair city? Is it the European Film Festival?
Not this time. Maybe next year. Now, I'm here as part of a group called the American Shale Manufacturing Partnership. It's a group of many different trade associations and university energy professionals. And really what we're doing is discussing sort of the issues that are surrounding the sort of build-out of the manufacturing renaissance that is being spawned by the shale revolution that, you know, is happening. Certainly started in Texas, Louisiana, but it's happening all over the country now. And discussing some of the issues on the downstream side of things in the manufacturing sector that communities and states can be doing to prepare themselves to really take full advantage of this manufacturing renaissance.
Well, the shale revolution that you're noting, how much of an impact has it had on Louisiana's economy? Can you quantify that?
Well, we did a study in 2012 that took into account, looked at the entire country and quantified the macroeconomic benefits. And we know that in Louisiana alone, again, 2012, that it just this shale development accounted for over 30,000 jobs, and it provided upwards of about $15 million in government revenue, and that's sort of on the early stages of things. Things have grown significantly and will continue to. And it's important to note too, especially in Baton Rouge, that even while we sort of start this early stage development of the Tuscaloosa Marine Shale, there are still massive benefits happening up and down the state, supporting drilling everywhere around the country. Louisiana has a tremendous workforce that has experience, you know, in the oil and gas sector from the upstream and the downstream. And when all of a sudden you're drilling in new places like Colorado or Pennsylvania or North Dakota, where that resource base isn't there, those companies have turned to the resources in Louisiana to help them there.
Are you confident, Christopher, that environmental concerns are being addressed adequately?
Absolutely. I mean, I travel all over the country, and you look at the regulatory regimes that have been put in place in the last few years. I think it's very clear that governors and community leaders understand that unconventional oil and gas development, and specifically utilizing hydraulic fracturing, can be done safely. It has been done safely for 60 years. But they're putting these regulatory regimes in place in order to give the public the absolute assurance that it will be done safely and that there'll be very stiff penalties if they're not.
297-5633 is your number in our remaining moments with Christopher Guth. He is Vice President for Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's Institute for 21st Century Energy. Earlier in the week, we had the state treasurer on this program, and he said the economic resurgence in Louisiana is almost exclusively related to the findings in shale and the natural gas boom that's taking place in this state. Governor Jindal certainly got some bad luck taking office in 2008 when the U.S. economy went south under President Bush, but he got some very good luck, didn't he, with this shale boom?
Yeah, I wouldn't say good luck. I mean, there.
Good luck in the timing.
Right. No. I mean, exactly. It could have. The technology could have evolved at any point in time. So there's good luck there. But I think Louisiana has been very smart in preparing itself to take full advantage of it. And I mean, the point that you make, or the point the treasurer made about how this has been the driving force behind Louisiana's economy, but that's true nationwide. I mean, if you look at what shale development has done across the country over the last 4 or 5 years, it has been really the only saving grace. And it's not necessarily just the drilling. It's this build-out of the downstream of the petrochemical and refining sector, which is also a huge boom in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast. But that whole whole development is really the golden goose that has kept our economy afloat.
Well, and listener Nell notes that not only has Governor Jindal been the beneficiary of some good luck in the timing of this, but certainly President Obama has. That would be a fair statement.
Absolutely. Like I said, I mean, this has kept our economy afloat during the worst recession that we've had since the Great Depression.
How long can it go?
You look play by play, and you have some plays that haven't even started to be developed yet. I mean, we're at the very, very early stages of Tuscaloosa Marine, and then you have other ones that we have a good decade behind. A lot of it depends on what the price of the commodities that are coming out of the ground are. But this is going to be a very sustained, from a nationwide perspective, a very sustained growth. And we look to see that, well into a 20 or 30-year time frame.
20 or 30 years. So is it going to explode to an even greater proportion, or is it going to settle in and just be something that we're counting on as a big part of our economy?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, right now we have some artificial constraints that is preventing it from growing even more. I mean, as folks in northern Louisiana know, up in the Haynesville, the price of natural gas is glutted. The industry has been a victim of its own success, producing more than we can consume, and we have barriers in bringing that gas to other countries who are willing to pay, three times more for it than what we pay here. Same is true with the liquids, specifically crude. We have an absolute export ban, and if those bans remain in place or those barriers remain in place, then you hit a sort of artificial glass ceiling where we can't grow anymore because there's no demand for it because we can't access that additional demand around the world. So that's a federal issue that is being dealt with in Washington, and hopefully because people around the country through their elected representatives make this point known, hopefully we can see some liberalization of our export policy so that we can see even more growth into the future.
Now, U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu is chair of the Energy Committee. Can she address this to your satisfaction?
She definitely can address it, and she and her counterpart, Lisa Murkowski, the ranking member, have been staunch advocates for liberalizing exports. I think it's fair to say that right now no one expects Congress to get to get something like this accomplished. They can't even necessarily get a bipartisan energy efficiency bill passed in the Senate. So maybe next Congress. Mm-hmm. But right now, I think the key is to put pressure on the White House, because there are many steps that can be taken at the administrative level that can allow greater exports, both natural gas as well as crude. And so I would certainly encourage folks who want to see this happen to let her know that they support what she's doing, and to do even more to pressure President Obama to allow greater exports.
Well, the members of Congress, as you note, are not one voice on this issue. You have some pronounced opposition. Are those who are against what you're doing, at least to the magnitude that it's being done, are environmental concerns primarily the reasons why?
Well, there's a little of both. I mean, there are people who hate fossil fuels, period, and they want to see them kept in the ground at all costs. And if you expand, if you allow more exports and that increases demand, that means more drilling. So there is a small minority of folks in the Congress who don't want to see exports, or don't want to, because they don't want to see any more drilling whatsoever. And then there are some who don't, I think, don't fully appreciate how big of an energy resource we have. I mean, are these restrictions to exports are rooted in policies from the 1970s, when we had the Arab oil embargo and we had huge shortages of gasoline and liquid fuels.
Let's go to Jim on I-10. Jim, be brief. You're on with Christopher Guth. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I wanted to point out that the low cost of natural gas is reportedly giving the United States companies, United States-based companies, a renewed competitive advantage over the rest of the world. If we allow all of this exporting, it's going to enrich the very few. It's going to drive the cost of gas up and eliminate the advantage we have against foreign competition. Exporting doesn't help anybody but the investment bankers. And, of course, the oil men, because the price will drive it up. But driving up the price of gas here in the United States is going to cost us jobs.
Is that fair?
I think I don't think that's accurate. I mean, the Department of Energy did a conclusive study that looked at a dozen different scenarios as far as what prices could be and how much we export, and they found that because the resource base of natural gas in this country is so large, that in all cases it would be a net benefit for the country to expand exports. We know that If we're going to be exporting, that means that there are new wells that can be brought online that right now are just sitting unconnected to gathering lines because the price is too low. So I'm not going to say that there wouldn't be any temporary price increase, but what these studies have found is that it would be very, very limited, and that it would still be a net benefit for the country, not just for the few.
Well, we thank you for joining us, Christopher Guth, Vice President for Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and we look forward to talking with you again. Hope you enjoy your stay here, Chris.
I have so far. Thank you, Jim.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And we're joined in studio in our remaining moments by some folks involved, with the Kids Orchestra concert tomorrow. And good morning, Jody.
Good morning.
And your last name is pronounced?
Ane.
Jody Ane.
Ane.
Jody,
yes.
Ane, and the gentleman you are with?
This is Dr. Jovan Zivkovic. He's our artistic director.
And the Kids Orchestra will be at the Christian Life Fellowship Church tomorrow at 4 o'clock. And this has become a big event.
It has. You know, I was here last year about this time announcing our concert, and we had about 75 children involved. And this year, we have about 500 children involved in our program. So we've taken a gigantic
from 75 to 500.
Yes,
so
sir.
That is huge.
Yes.
And Dr. Zivkovic, right?
Yes.
Dr. Johan Zivkovic. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Serbia, but I took my 2 degrees at LSU, so I'm pretty much familiar with the area here.
Well, You enjoy working with these kids?
Oh, tremendously. It's a great pleasure working with all of them. Now we have two orchestra, which involves almost 200 kids just playing together. Mm-hmm. And the fact that those kids, after 3 months, some after 2 years, are able to sit together and play together, make music together, it's an amazing thing.
From 75 last year to 500 this year, tomorrow 4 o'clock at Christian Life Fellowship, what will we hear?
We're going to hear all of them, all 500 of them playing in a different groups. We are going to hear them playing on their instruments in their studio setting, which means that violins are going to play together, and the same is going to go for violas, cellos, flutes, clarinets, trumpets, and percussionists.
And the age ranges?
The ages, it's elementary school, K-1 to 4.
Yeah, kindergarten to 4.
Yes.
So we're talking about young kids who are getting indoctrinated early on with the beauty of music.
We have our foundation class, which are pre-K kids, which are going to sing. So, they're all going to be there tomorrow.
Thank you.
We'll
be back Monday.
Until then,
I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.